Shalom. Shalom, chaverim.
We don't need some, like, are there any Spanish speakers here? Gringos.
You know what are gringos?
Yes.
Okay. Raise your hand if you would like me at the microphone. I like that honesty. Beautiful. Okay, so yes, I've spent many years in Southern California, right on the border of Mexico, and gringos is the enduring term used by Mexican Spanish-speaking people for non-Mexican people attempting to speak Spanish. Gringo. You don't want to look like a gringo when you land in Tel Aviv. So instead, what you need to do is you need to summon your inner spitting camel. So try this. Bach. Loch Ness Monster. Chaverim. Oh! Okay, let's try that from the top. Shalom, chaverim. There you go. No gringos here. Thank you so much for this opportunity to join you in prayer, in heart, in connection. I'm delighted to be with you today. And I talked to Trish for a while. What should we address together? I was so delighted to receive an invitation. And we thought, what is Judaism? And can we give folks lots of time to think about that? And this was such a popular topic that they're coming from all over. Oh, never mind. My reputation for bad puns must have preceded me. So, as you may know, we thought that it might be worth kind of starting off with Judaism, myths, and facts. Now, I'm sure that none of you would, just absorb any of the culture or the history or the society's views that might have emphasized myths about Jewish people for the last 2,000 years or so. But just, so I know you wouldn't have any, you know, thoughts about Jews that might be stereotypical. You're a giggly bunch, hey? That would be so Jewish. So not your thoughts, but people who you've come across in your life, you know, what are things that you've heard other people say about Jews? Not your thoughts, of course, but out there in the big world, what are some of the myths or stereotypes or assertions or truths that you've heard about the Jews? So take a moment. Find your inner misinformed neighbor and take just a moment. I'll tell you what. Jewish learning and engagement in conversation. Do you know the word goisha? It's kind of like gringo, only different. Well, it's interesting because goy is actually a Hebrew word that goes back to biblical times, which means nation. Like, lo yisa goy al goy cherev. One nation shall not lift up sword against another nation. Lo yilmadu od milchamad. They shall not learn war anymore. So goy is a neutral kind of sociological term. It's a people, right? Noongar people, Irish people, Russian people, Jewish people, right? But over time, goy comes to have a connotation of non-Jew in particular. This is a historical, it's a change in the evolution of the language. When we move all the way into the later medieval time and we end up with a word like goyshe, which means goy-like, it kind of means non-Jewish, right? So non-Jewish study. That's like the universities, the Ivy Towers, the quiet libraries. Jewish study is more like this. How many angels fit on the head of a pin? A pin, you say, what kind of pin? A safety pin? A clothespin? A clothespin? Are you Meshuggah? No, no, no. We need to know about angels. This is not about clothes. Okay. Jewish study is engaging and loud and vibrant and there's a lot of discourse, even argument. Okay, why are we saying this? Because Goisha is like the not mainstream Jewish way, Jewish, kind of loud and engaged and connected. So in our Jewish halls of learning, we're all talking. We'll go back half a step. We were going to think of some myths about Judaism we know. Take 15 seconds, turn to the person next to you, come up together with one or two myths or generalizations you've heard about Judaism. It should get loud now. Yeah, now this sounds more like a synagogue. Sometimes this sounds like a synagogue during the prayers. It depends where you go. Okay, you can stop now. Time's up. Chamesh, Arba, Shalosh, Shtayim, Echad, Efes. Or as we do in the schools, Echad, Shtayim, Shalosh, Yadayim, Al HaRosh. Okay, enough of that. Okay, so let's take them on. You know, we can have some facts, we can have some myths, but we'll also think a lot about what has led to the understandings that we have and what we can discover about one another and how we can build up our understanding. And I love to learn more in conversation and look forward to learning from you. So, myths or facts? Myths and facts. Who might like to start?
Being a member of Jewish faith, not born Jew.
Great. The question was, can one be, I'm free. See, that's another thing. The problem with holding the microphone is I can't use two hands to talk. You can't stay still because it says in Deuteronomy that you should v'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha b'chol levavecha u'v'chol nafshecha u'v'chol me'odecha. And it's repeated again in Luke that you should love the Eternal One, your God, with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. And Jewishly, all your might includes your physical energy. It's very hard for us to stay still. Or maybe that's just me. The question was, can we be Jewish if we're not, if one is not born Jewish, can one be Jewish? And the answer is yes, indeed. So one may be Jewish because one is born to a Jewish parent. One may be Jewish because one follows a path to conversion. Now, conversion into Judaism is not an easy path. It takes a very long time, a lot of dedication, years actually of study, and a real demonstration of understanding the concepts and being able to live according to the Jewish life ways. We are not a proselytizing religion. And you might be asking yourself, self, I wonder why it's so hard to become Jewish. You know, you can't rock up to the door, declare your belief in a few sentences, and become Jewish. It's the faith, having faith, does not open the door to becoming Jewish. It's much more involved, right? So why is this the case, you might be wondering? Well, part of the reason is because in the Middle Ages in Europe, if an individual converted into Judaism and was allowed into the Jewish community in medieval Europe, then there would be brutal attacks against the community, and Jews would be killed for allowing Christians to become Jewish. This was a pretty significant factor in discouraging people from becoming Jews in the Middle Ages. That's no longer a factor, of course, but it really became embedded in Jewish thought and community and approach. But there's really more to it as well, which is there are some religions that emphasize proselytizing, as in, follow our path and you will be saved. Follow our path and you will go to heaven. Do not follow our path and you will not go to heaven, and perhaps in some communities even, do not follow our path and you will be damned eternally, right? Judaism is not like that. We believe there are many paths to the top of the mountain, and as long as a person is a good person, a decent, upright human being, then olam haba, all the goodness that can be, will be with that person. You don't need to be a Jew to be saved. You don't need to be a Jew to be good. You don't need to be a Jew to be in the presence of the Holy Blessed One at the end of time. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
With pleasure. Who's next?
The obvious one is the, you know, the international money conspiracy around the world stuff, which pops up every now and then.
Yeah, you know, I was really hoping that was going to be a truth and not a myth, because, like, I could use a couple million dollars, you know? I don't know. It's funny. There aren't a lot of multi-faith groups in Western Australia, in Perth. Very hard to keep them going, but there is one up in the hills, Now I'm forgetting where it was. Up near Helena Valley, right? If anyone's interested, I can give you details. We get together. It was initiated by myself and an Anglican church and a Baha'i community, beautiful, up around Mundaring. So we welcome people of all backgrounds and have people from every kind of religious background welcome to speak about different topics at different times. We sat in this big circle, and we all talk about mutual respect, and this really beautiful man sitting close to me I don't know how to do this. Okay, my brother's best friend is Egyptian, and his Egyptian Muslim mom taught my mom how to make baklava. And we were in central Michigan, and everybody was Christian except for his family and our family, for all intents and purposes. So, like, we have nice, close, beautiful relationships with all different kinds of people. But this particular individual who happened to be Muslim in the middle of this big, open, multi-faith gathering started talking about how all the Jews own Hollywood and the Jews own all the banks and the Jews own, you know. And I said, I really wish I did. Like, first of all, I would like a role in Hollywood. And then second of all, I want to have, like, lottery winnings without winning the lottery. Why? Oh, without buying a ticket. So where does this myth come from? What was that? Okay, tell us.
Well, because the Christians had a rule that they weren't allowed to spend money, they thought, still want a banking system,
still want to be able to borrow money, so we can get the Jews to do that because they don't have that rule, so we'll make them the bankers, and then we'll really give them hard stick about it and make out like they're the really greedy, manipulative ones because they're the ones controlling all the money.
That is a great summary. Thank you so much. Christianity in the Middle Ages, again, did not allow for Christians. Oh, nice. So there was a teaching, medieval Christianity did not let Christians lend to one another. By the Middle Ages, Jews had been kicked out of so many countries that we covered a lot of Europe and North Africa and the ancient Near East. There were a lot of trade routes because there was common language, common culture, connected families because of marriage. And yes, certainly there was trade that went back and forth. Now, this is augmented by the fact that Jews could not own land and could not participate in certain kinds of businesses. So there were a lot of restrictions on what Jews could do. And certainly some did lend money. Now, really interesting that this myth of Jews as the money lender has been around for a long time. Shakespeare contributed to it. And less attractive and well-known, the Nazis contributed to it. So in the 20s, part of what the Nazis did was to dig up a lot of Jewish hatred from the past in order to consolidate Germany of that time towards Nazism. And it's always easier to consolidate hatred than it is to consolidate love. So part of what they were doing was villainizing the Jews, and part of how they did that was by tapping into ancient myths. Interestingly enough, when we've gone back and actually looked at the financial records of the Middle Ages and the financial records of the Jewish communities, which we've been able to do because kings collected taxes, yes? They collected taxes from Jews, they collected taxes from non-Jews. And there are records that we can still find on how much money was collected from which communities. And because the Jews were segregated so much, it was very clear where the money was coming from. So what is found out? Yes, there certainly were Jews that were lending huge amounts of money to some nobles because they couldn't borrow from Christians. They could borrow from Jews, and then it's always really convenient to borrow from somebody who's already alienated and stigmatized and has no power. And then if you don't want to pay back the loan, what do you do? Arrest them, murder them, kick them out of your country. It's a great system if you're a king. But what was found out was that, yes, well, there were a certain percentage of Jewish people who were in big lending. The vast majority of the Jewish people were poor as dirt, like the rest of the people of the Middle Ages. So the actual proportion of Jewish money lenders was quite low, and we can see that from the tax records. So again, well, there's a basis of truth which very much comes out of what you've said. There has also been an emphasis on this concept and a building up of it to create a greater sense of hatred against the Jews. That was particularly useful and effective for the Nazis, and at various other times, various other peoples. I'm going to tag onto that just a little bit, because there's also, if you're very interested in history, we could talk later about the court Jews of the early pre-modern times, Renaissance-y times, but it's a little esoteric and very historical. But if you're interested in court Jews, somebody can ask me about that too.
Apart from my Shakespearean education about Jewish people, also this idea that post-Second World War Jewish people were all tailors or pawnbrokers, and their sons were all doctors and lawyers.
Tailors and pawnbrokers before the war, and doctors and lawyers after the war. You know, one of the interesting things about Judaism and Jewish history is we got really experienced at certain things. One of them was arguing. Remember my demonstration of Jewish study? You know, where Judaism is not doctrinal, right? And we're not dogmatic. We don't have any of those dog things, right? So we can't say, your dogma ran over my karma. No, my karma, okay, never mind. So one of the things we got really good at was leaving, because we kept getting kicked out of countries, yes? So we go back to the Babylonian exile, and then, of course, we have a Roman exile, and then later on we get expelled from England, we get expelled from most of the countries of Europe, actually, and then, of course, there's the expulsion from Spain, followed closely by the well-known Inquisition, and then that follows us into Portugal, and then, of course, that even follows us to the New World. We have needed to move around a lot because we've been expelled from so many countries, amongst other things. So when you need to leave a country quickly, now I'm not sure how many immigrants there are in this room. I myself am an immigrant. But when we have to leave a place, and especially when we have to leave it quickly, is it easy to bring all of our stuff, our factories, our materials, our resources? Sometimes you're lucky to get out with a shirt on your back, yes? But what is it that no one can ever steal? What's in your head, your learning, your understanding, skills also, especially what you know. And knowledge came to be such an important component of Jewish culture and society. It was actually very much valued almost above wealth in certain ways. Not everybody can have wealth, but everybody can have learning. In the Middle Ages, when literacy rates were very low amongst non-Jews, essentially Europe was relatively illiterate if you weren't a priest, more or less, or part of a nobility. In Judaism, the children were all learning to read. Yes, the men, the boys, much more than the girls. But essentially, all of the boys were taught how to read. And books were around everything. And even if girls weren't taught how to read, they were watching their brothers do it. They were going to synagogue where everybody was able to read, right? You would read a prayer book. It wasn't just that you heard it. In a setting where you can only hear the word, whoever is speaking the word has quite a lot of. But in a setting where everybody can read together, no wonder we have so many arguments in Judaism. Okay, so I think it's not entirely surprising that given really a couple thousand years that emphasize the importance of knowledge, of learning, of we call it pilpul, very careful reading and analysis, where we, in times that we say, at Pesach, at Passover, we say, the more that we discuss things, the further down we take it, how much we can stand it on its head for the Kabbalists, for the mystics. We don't just read like the black letters you had up on the wall. It was beautiful singing with you. But we are not supposed to read the black letters only. We're also supposed to read the white spaces around those black letters. We're supposed to read the white space in the middle of the letter O, if we had a letter O. We have other letters that have centers, like the final mem. But the idea of reading and thinking and creating is just, it's holy. We're taught that any disagreement for the sake of heaven is good. It's, that one wasn't a joke. No, like, because as long, like, if you were arguing about when the Sabbath starts, right? Well, it's still about the Sabbath.
I was recording in a Jewish band.
Oh, cool.
And every arrangement was decided by fierce debate and whoever was left standing.
you know what I'm talking about.
No one was in charge.
Yeah.
And you couldn't get your ear from your head. Yeah. So the
Well, you can see how that's sort of an equalizing factor, right? Was this, what kind of music? Klezmer! Oi, beautiful. All right, we might have people in common. So, I mean, that's how Judaism is. It's like klezmer. It's many solos and interactions and harmonies and dissonance and syncopation. This is not, my daughter was sitting here like shocked. Amazing grace, like that's everything's on the beat. It's all harmonious. That's not how we do it. Okay, so when you have a couple thousand years of think, use your mind, disagree, find the shortcoming, find a new way around it, is it surprising that they're lawyers? I mean, this is what we've been doing for thousands of years. Similarly, you know, just. The sense of the value of knowledge is huge. There are a lot of really famous Jewish physicians in Jewish history who are great thinkers and rabbis as well. As far as the tailors and peddlers, yes. And that also goes back to the Middle Ages where you can't own land, you can't have a farm, you can't, you know, when their guilds emerge, you can't be in a guild, you can't go to a university, you can't. So what do? You do what you can to survive. So that is very much based on fact and experience. You know, I don't quite know why, but every once in a while you get these emails that come through. Well, I don't know if you do, but I do. They talk about the percentage of Nobel Prize winners who were Jewish. It's curious, but it's not a bad thing from our perspective. It really seems to be that there's a tremendous emphasis on knowing and building oneself up. And because there was so much poverty and so much destruction and so many murdered, you don't have the inheritance of previous generations to build your own house. It's not because you inherited it from before. You have to build it yourself. And I'm not saying that as a good or as a bad, but that sense of what you have is what you've got. Make the world and make the world a better place.
I was going to mention something that follows on from that. In the medical world, there are a lot of very high-level Jewish doctors, mainly Jewish men. I can't think of very many Jewish women who are high-up medical people, but there's also a lot of Jewish hospitals or hospitals that are named after Jewish places, things, yeah. Concepts, yes. Whatever. So it seems that the medical world is a very important part of what Jews contribute to.
That's a very nice way of framing it. Here's another Hebrew word, right? So far we have goy, we have goyish, we have chaver, and here's a new word, hahefech. And this kind of fits into that what we were talking about before about debate, about turning things over. Hahefech means turn it over. Cafe afuch is mostly coffee, cafe afuch. It's turned over. It's mostly milk and a little coffee instead of mostly coffee and a little milk. Okay, so hehefech, it's almost part the opposite. The reason that there are many, many, as it were, Jewish hospitals, especially in larger Jewish cities, Los Angeles, New York, I don't know how many there are in Australia. I don't know if, does Melbourne and Sydney have like a Beth Israel or a Cedar Sinai? These great hospitals in Los Angeles, are Beth Israel and Cedar Sinai. So why is there this history of Jewish hospitals? Why are nurses called sisters here? Why were nurses called sisters here? Because of holy orders and nuns. A lot of the hospitals originally were Christian institutions. Was that a good place to get kosher food? The Jewish people made Jewish hospitals to take care of their own when we didn't have other places that we could go to comfortably or where we would be welcomed and treated well. There's a Noongar school here in Perth. Why is that? There's some reasons we need. There's a deaf school. Why is that? There's some needs that are particular that can end up being a good thing. It could end up being a bad thing. The Jewish hospitals were built because the Jews needed them. The Jewish hospitals were built because of the same reasons that Jewish orphanages and schools and universities and lending centers and immigrant aid societies were built. Because it was needed, and we take care. I mean, look at you guys are beautiful. You stand here and you say, "Oh, hey, does anybody have an extra room for my child? Oh, hey, here's some containers we can all share." You share with your community. We're doing the same thing.
I'm just curious. You mentioned a lack of dogma and a lack of doctrine. How does the Orthodox Jewish community within Israel fit within that?
Oh, fabulous. Okay, great question. Dogma and doctrine. You know what they do? This is so awesome. Just as in Christianity, where there are many, many different expressions of Christianity, right? The Greek Orthodox and the Roman Catholic, and I have friends who speak in tongues, and I have a friend who's a friar. He's a Franciscan friar. Like, liberal Catholic and Catholic. Like, there's a whole world, yeah? So we do that too, only more. So even, like, the Orthodox, right? If you talk about the Orthodox Christians, hey, is that Greek Orthodox or is that Russian Orthodox or is that Balkan Orthodox? So we do that too. The Orthodox in Israel are like 50 different flavors of black hat. I'm not even kidding. Some of the black hats like tip up in the front and some of them tip down. And some of them like are all the way around, and some of them are high and some of them are short. Now you guys are giggling, right? But would you walk into the cathedral in shorts and tennis shoes or barefoot today if you went to you know, St. George's on the cathedral? Would that be normative there? Right? We different I'd like to take my shoes off. But I like this. But we know that there are a lot of different expressions of Christianity and Judaism. So in terms of dogma, and it's all a question of degree. For example, this morning your New Testament reading was from Romans. Do we think they're doing the same thing at the cathedral, you know, by the hospital, at the Catholic one? They'll read at least, they'll have two songs, not just one. So my answer to this is, there's another great Jewish quip. When there are two Jews, there are three views. Two Jews, three views. So this is true in Orthodoxy as much as it is within more progressive Judaism. The nature of the questions will change. There is a value in Judaism that's called tznius, which means modesty. In the book of Micah, we are told that you should do justice, love mercy, and walk with tznius before God, tzniut. It doesn't exactly mean humility. What is it? How is that usually translated? Love, mercy, humbly. But it's not the Hebrew, right? Sniut. It's not humble like a mouse. It's more of not boastfully, right? Not like ha, it's all about me, right? That would be in the Hebrew. Sniut can also mean modesty of like body, right? I think I'm looking pretty sneeze today, don't you think? I bought this dress for my daughter's bat mitzvah last year. Okay. But there's sneeze and there's sneeze. I mean, I don't really want to be too risque, but can you all see my collarbone? I went with a friend in Los Angeles to his family's Very Orthodox shul. He described them, this is back in the 90s, as Taliban Orthodox Jews. And they were from Iraq. It was an Iraqi Jewish congregation. And one of his cousins came up to me, and I was wearing a dress a lot like this, but it had long sleeves, right? I was being sneeze, because in some of the Orthodox communities, covering your shoulders is not enough. Covering your elbows is not enough. Sometimes covering down to your wrist is not enough. You need to cover like about a thumb beyond your wrist. That's how you be modest, right? So I'm wearing a dress like this, but it has long sleeves. And this cousin of his comes up and goes like, "Don't you have anything decent to wear?" And she grabs my collar to cover up my clavicles, right? Because I was being way too risque. So in terms of like doctrine and dogma, that's not a dogmatic issue. It's not a doctrinal issue. The concept is that we are B'Tselem Elohim. We're made in God's image, and so our bodies should be treated with respect and joy, but not without thinking, right? So what is core in Judaism no matter what? Because I'll tell you, there's a lot of disagreement. One. One God. One God who is incorporeal. One God who cannot be seen or touched or embodied in any way, shape, or form. If you do not embrace this concept, you are basically outside the circle of Judaism. One God. That's it. I have numerous Christian friends who say, "Oh, there's a Jewish man in our church, and he said such and so, and he teaches us Hebrew, and he believes in Jesus." This is someone who converted from Judaism into Christianity, embraced a belief in Jesus as God. Jewishly, he is not a Jew anymore. If you embrace anything other than the one all eternal God as God, you're outside of Judaism. Okay, that's number one. Number two, that's really the main one, except in so much as the Torah taken broadly, meaning the five books of Moses, right? Genesis through Deuteronomy. The rest of the Hebrew and Aramaic scriptures, which are also sacred, and the life ways that emerge from those through 600 years of debate, discussion, and disagreement that comes to be known as the Talmud, which forms the codes known also as halakha, where halakha means the way. It's actually very much like the Tao, you know, in Taoism. So where Tao is the way, halakha is the way. It's the walk. It's the path of life, which has grown out of the understandings from Talmud, which are rooted in Torah, history, life, and lore. But that becomes vast, right? And there's so many differences and possibilities within those things. So Shabbat is important across the board. But to what degree one observes, there's a huge range. Did that answer your question? The question was, what about the Orthodox in terms of dogma and doctrine? Do they all have the same dogma and doctrine? So let me...
The question was more along the lines of, the statement was, there is no dogma and doctrine. And so, for example, within the Christian faith, I can see the Catholic Church have a certain dogma and doctrine, which we don't share, but they have theirs. It seems to me that the Orthodox Jews do adhere to a certain dogma and doctrine that maybe is not common across Judaism, but dogma and doctrine does exist within Judaism.
I understand what you're saying. And what I would suggest is that in Judaism, the discussion is more about practice than about dogma or doctrine. So the focus is more on what is done and how is it done, more than what is believed and how it is expressed. The expression is an action. So Christianity might emphasize more a sense of faith and acts. And if one were really, really forced to say, well, ultimately, what's the most important, there might be some groups. Well, you guys think, overall, if really, really, really pressed to the nth degree, let's say that faith is this direction and acts is that direction, Which would you kind of feel like Christianity might lean more towards, faith, towards acts? It's an unfair question, I know. Come on. Okay, so, you know, it's something to think about. But let me say that in Judaism, definitely acts are crucial, right? The faith is secondary. The acts are primary. And I think that that makes a difference. Doctrinally, Orthodoxy is halachically bound, whereas Progressive Judaism, which is the movement that I'm rooted in, is not halachically bound. We say the halacha gets a vote but not a veto. In Orthodoxy, the halacha is the way, but the halacha offers a range of possibilities also. So where one sits within that halacha can vary tremendously. Here in Perth, we have four Orthodox congregations, and every one of them is different from each other. It's chalk and cheese and pastels and pretzels. They're like quite different from each other. Hey.
Young people have just returned from, and they have some questions, some of which you will have answered a little already, or greatly.
Maybe.
The first question that these young people have asked is the main difference between the Jewish faith and Christianity. That's question number one. And I'll tell you all of them because you might want to answer them all together. The second question is, what is the most important and main event in the Jewish calendar? And the third one is, why are people Jewish?
These are great questions. You know what? Some of these questions I have never been asked to address before. Now, I'm going to tiptoe gently. I think I'm going to go around the other way. Oh, yes, that would be a terrible sound. Okay, wait. Hold on. Where we go? This is the way, the truth. Okay. Hello, people. How are you doing? Ooh, no feedback. Hello, daughter. Thank you. Beautiful. Thank you. These are really, really great questions. So, well done. I think I'm going to start with the easy one, which is, what is the most important and main event in the Jewish calendar? There is some kinds of debate about this, of course, because we're Jews. And a lot of people would probably say that it's around the time of the Jewish high holy days, the new year when we sound the shofar, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, when we fast and try to get ourselves right with other people in our world and with our God. Some people would say Passover is the most important day, and that's the time that the most Jewish people actually engage in Jewish practice. So even those who are perhaps less connected to synagogue life are most likely to participate at Passover time. Christianity associates that time with the time of Jesus' Last Supper, and Passover always takes place right around Easter time. But actually, the main response to your question, what's the most important event in the Jewish calendar, is Shabbat, Sabbath. So the Bible tells us in Genesis that God creates the universe, creates the world in 6 days, and on the seventh day, God kicks back and just loves it all. And that's what we do every week. On the seventh day, we're told we should rest just as the Holy Blessed One did. Every single week, the Sabbath is like, oh, I don't know. You like Shabbat, Aliyah? No homework? No cleaning the house? No chores? No errands? No mom working like crazy? Going to friends' houses and eating lots of good food? That's when, if we get new clothes during the week, we put our new clothes on for the first time on Shabbat. It's a joy. The Sabbath is our most important day. And every single week, we take the time to reconnect to our family, the things that matter most, our synagogues, our tradition, our learning. Shabbat, the Sabbath. When you come to one of our synagogues eventually, if you'd like to visit with us, you would hear people saying, Shabbat Shalom, Sabbath peace to you. Shabbat Shalom. Want to try that one? Shabbat Shalom. Ooh, we're really building up that Jewish vocabulary. Okay, number two. How is the Jewish faith different to Christianity? Yes? That's a pretty huge one. One of the things we were speaking about a little bit before was sort of the key Jewish concept being, what was that key Jewish concept, folks? One God. So Judaism is very clear about being monotheistic and about God who cannot be embodied, incorporeal, not showing God's self physically in any form. Maybe it's like we can see the footprints, you know, in the beauty of creation, in the beauty of one another created in God's image. But for Judaism, God cannot be in a physical form. So that's one tremendous difference, whereas for mainstream Christianity, God becomes embodied in historical Jesus. Is that correct? Okay. So that is a massive difference. So from a Jewish perspective, anyone who would believe in Jesus as God would by definition not be Jewish. Now, it's not my place to say what's right and what's wrong. I know what's right for me. I'm not telling you, and I'm certainly not telling you, what's true or what's not true. I'm just telling you that that is a belief totally outside of Judaism, right? So that's one big difference. Similarly, are you Trinitarian? You guys? Okay. So the sense of Holy Spirit as potentially separate from God, God's own self, like the idea of Father, Son, Holy Spirit, that also would not be part of Judaism, because for us, God is just absolutely one and oneness, right? So that's really core. In Christianity, there's a belief that, well, maybe you can help me. What's the Christian belief about the Messiah? In Christianity, do we know who the Messiah is? Yes, good. In Christianity, Jesus is described as the Messiah who has been on the earth one time. And anything y'all are especially looking forward to in the future, we have to send you back to Sunday school. Okay, so Christianity is very much looking forward to what in relation to Jesus? Christianity is very much looking forward to Jesus returning, the second coming. For Judaism, this one's pretty huge. I guess this could be, I'm not going to worry about if it's dogma or doctrine. But for Judaism, we'll know the Messiah is here when every child can smile and play and go to a park and have enough to eat. When every person will be treated with decency regardless of their shape, their size, the color of their skin. When it doesn't matter if you're a male or a female or what neighborhood you're walking in or you're however you want to define yourself based on the truth of your soul, but you're safe anywhere you go because nobody's going to touch you in some way or say something to you that's not all right. We know that the Messiah is here when people are not being raped, when there's not going to be incest, when there's not going to be bigotry, when there's not going to be racism. We'll know when everybody has enough food to eat and equal access to every vaccine. That's when we know the Messiah is there. And for us as Jews, until that happens, we haven't arrived. And our job is to be partners with God to bring that on as soon as we can. And if we can't do that for the whole wide world, we do it where we're at. We offer somebody else a place to put their feet. We offer somebody else something to eat if they're sitting in the street without. Our job is to be partners with God to repair this still broken world. And when we do that, oh, we'll know. Why are we Jews? Why are people Jewish? Some of us are Jewish because our moms were Jewish, or maybe because our dads were Jewish, or maybe because there was something in our heart that made us feel like we could not possibly turn our back on something that was calling us. The Hasidim call it a voice calling from Sinai. Like, hey, you belong here. Hey, come on. Right? It's like a call from home. It's like, I'm getting hungry. It's time for dinner. I've got to go there, you know? And for some of us, it's just the sense that we must be part of working in this particular way with these particular people to try to make the world a little more whole. An incredibly brief story because our time is nearing the end. Oh, let's hear Hannah's question, and then we'll have our final Kabbalistic story. Hello, Hannah. That's a beautiful Bible Hebrew name.
Why do you wear a hat like that?
Great question.
And what's it called?
Thank you so much. This hat is called a kippah, or a yarmulke. And this particular kippah is my daughter's. She let me borrow it today. I think it goes nicely with the dress. What do you think? It's okay. Okay. Do you have a mom or a dad? Are they around here?
Oh.
Is there a mom around here? Or she's not here? Hi, Mom. Hey, Mom, what's on your finger? You wear a wedding ring. That sounds very nice. Oh, you do too. You both wear wedding rings. Let me ask, why do you wear wedding rings? It's a symbol of your commitment to each other. Funny, because I wear a kippah as a symbol of my commitment to God and Judaism. If you didn't wear your wedding ring, would you forget about him? I am awfully... And you?
So you're not trying to play sport.
But do you forget? No. So your mom and dad don't need to wear their wedding rings to remember each other and to love each other. But it's just a little symbol. It's a pretty beautiful reminder of their connection. I wear a kippah because for me and for Jewish people, it's a beautiful reminder of our connection to the Blessed Holy One and to other Jewish people. That's a great question. So a very brief story, because I know that there is a very particular time we need to wrap up here. But it goes like this. Some scholars tell us that there actually are two creation narratives in the Bible, that Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 are each a distinct creation narrative. We could talk about that at some other time. But if two wasn't enough, because remember, two Jews... Oh, I like you guys. So we need to have a third story, obviously. And it goes a little bit like this. Now, this is a very Kabbalistic story. It comes from Jewish mysticism. Normally, we don't share that with groups larger than three or with people who are under 40 years old. But I think I can trust y'all. Once upon a time, a long, long time ago, what there was God. The holy, blessed oneness of being, shining, sparkling, pulsating, existing through all that was, and that's all that was. And then at some point, that amazing, incredible, eternal oneness, for some reason we might never know, chose to make a universe. But because God's godliness filled up all that was, God needed to make a space where all that would become would be. And so in order to do that, according to the Kabbalists, God contracts God's self. Like you could push a balloon in, right? God contracts God's self in God's light, in God's beauty, and then there is a space within which all can come to be. But with that compressed light of God, it needed to go somewhere. According to the Kabbalists, this compressed light of God gets put into great vessels filled with God's pulsating, amazing light. And there it sits, and God creates the universe. And eventually, you come along. But in the meantime, those vessels, can anything truly hold all the light of the Holy Blessed One? So what happens to those vessels? Those vessels break open. And all the light that was inside of them gets scattered around everywhere and every which way. Here, there, there, there. Even under there. In everything that's beautiful in the world and everything that's ugly in the world, everything, every hair, every bit of it has some essence of the great holiness. But it's all messed up. Our job is to find those sparks of light and holiness and put them back where they belong. And every time we do that, we are making greater holiness and we are working to recreate the oneness. And that's our job. And that's why we're here. And that's why be we Jews or Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, atheists, we are all on this journey together. May your journey be filled with love and light and blessings.